one doesn't do it.
Items due to scheduling considerations and my desire to make sure that we have enough time to give to the SSC report. So we're going to take the 1150 agenda item, Ocean Observatories Initiative, OOI, behind tab number 1, document number 6. We have Al Pluteman from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He's got a brief presentation and looking for feedback from council members, so I'll turn it over to you, Al. Thank you.
Thank you. As you noted, I'm Al Pluteman. I'm a physical oceanographer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and I'm here today representing the National Science Foundation Ocean Observatories Initiative. I'll try to be concise, but I also want to try and give you a sense of the breadth of the program. There's been discussion in the oceanographic scientific community for roughly a decade about ocean observatories, and I would summarize that by saying that there's a consensus that the technology has arrived and the time has come and the need is appropriate for sustained observing in the oceans to improve scientific understanding as well as stewardship and policy decisions. And this is a worldwide sort of phenomenon. This is not unique to the New England shelf by any stretch. And the idea of providing multidisciplinary observations at important and yet undersampled locations is moving ahead in nationally as well as internationally. And this is one manifestation of that process. The Ocean Observatories of this initiative was developed with particular science themes. I won't read through all those, but rather say that the idea was to be broad in discipline and approach, as well as cover the air-sea interface through the water column to the seafloor. So broad and comprehensive was the goal. The organization, this is one slide I think I added that's not in your packet. It's worth seeing the organization of this. It is a National Science Foundation initiative. It is big enough that it has an intermediate management organization, which is the Consortium for Ocean Leadership in D.C. Through there, it spreads out to multiple implementing organizations, which tend to be focused at academic institutions, Woods Hole, University of Washington, with partners at Scripps and Oregon State. And so within that matrix there, the Pioneer Array off the New England coast falls under the Coastal Global Implementing Organization, with the Woods Hole Oceanographic being the prime contractor. I'm not going to dwell on this, but just to give you a sense that this overall observatories initiative is a big program. It's multifaceted. Depending on how you count it, you could count sort of 8 different installations. There are 4 high-latitude arrays, 2 coastal arrays, a cable observatory, and a cyber infrastructure. And so this Pioneer Array off New England is, by one measure, say 1/8 of this program. Those 2 coastal arrays I mentioned very briefly, if you concentrate on the right-hand side of this figure, you'll see we're starting to focus in on the New England shelf here. That's where the so-called Pioneer Array will be proposed or is being proposed. This is a prototypical shelf break system where the coastal waters butt up against the shelf sea waters influenced by the Gulf Stream, and there's a persistent, although intermittent, frontal system that runs all the way from Newfoundland, arguably, to Cape Hatteras. And so that system is the one that we're trying to explore. The schedule for this, because it is multifaceted, is fairly complex. This is the significantly simplified version, and even within this, we can simplify our lives here by just looking down at the coastal arrays, and within that, the Pioneer Array. And what you'll see is installation in the third quarter of 2012 of gliders. This is the first element of the Pioneer Array that would go in. And then in 2013, about a year later, we would begin to establish the moored array, and the autonomous vehicles. And I'll talk more about all those elements in a minute. So the time frame is 2012 to 2013, with proposed completion by 2014. I'll go through this fairly quickly. I'm sure everyone in this room is aware of most of this, but what we're interested in is that, in a sense, that white line there, which represents a very complex boundary between the shelf system and the offshore Gulf Stream influence system. This frontal zone is, in addition to being a fascinating physical system, is a rich environment for multiple trophic levels, as you all well know. So to first order, this frontal system is a boundary. It prevents the exchange of materials, nutrients, salt, heat between the offshore ocean and the shelf sea. That's not the part we're interested in, actually. We're interested in the second order part of that, which is the exchange between those two. And there are a variety of hypotheses running the gamut from surface wind mitigated interactions to bottom boundary layer interactions as to how and when nutrients and other elements are exchanged between the shelf and slope. It's that complex system that we're trying to explore with this installation. Again, telling you things you're well aware of, but I like this figure from the National Resource Defense Council where a variety of priority areas for ecosystems were mapped, and then the overlay of those areas were noted by increasingly dark colors, and you see that a number of areas overlap near the coastal zone, which is not too surprising. The next most important area, though, is that shelf break system, which we're proposing to explore. There are, of course, profound implications, not only relating to the exchange between the shelf and the slope sea, which is kind of our first sort of priority, but also connections to climate from the north through higher latitude regime shifts that essentially propagate down into this shelf region, and from the south relating to proposed or likely changes in the Gulf Stream and its meandering system. So I'll sort of stop there with the background. There's a kind of an hour-long science talk that goes along with that, but I would suggest that one of these brochures that I picked up is a good example, this biology of Northeast Continental Shelf. You will see these themes echoed almost word for word in there. So we're on the same page in terms of the kind of ecosystem themes that we're going after. If we go into a little more detail and look at the frontal dynamics, we start to think about the scales that we need to observe, and I think that's important to try and keep in our minds. So what you see there, and the figure is not the best reproduced, but you see two things depicted, a change in the water properties, salinity I believe is what's contoured there, from the shelf to the slope sea, and overlaid on that is a current, isotax of current, which represents a jet. So there's a shelf, what we call the shelf break jet. It's near the place where the continental shelf breaks and turns into the continental slope. It tends to be situated there persistently, although it's not particularly steady, and that's part of what we're trying to understand. And we know that there's a fairly consistent water mass, and if you plotted, say, nutrients instead of salinity, you'd see a similar picture. So the thing to think about there is that the scale of variability is about 10 kilometers or 6 miles, both for that salinity change and the current system. So small scales need to be resolved in order to understand the system. The cartoon is another view of that. I won't go through all the processes here, but it gives you a sense that we're trying to get at a multiple interconnected sort of complex system. We're interested in how both short-term synoptic and climate forcing is going to be reflected in the physics and there eventually move through to the ecosystem response. That's another way of saying what I said earlier. We're interested in the exchange of material properties and nutrients between the shelf and the slope as it is mitigated or determined by the variability of this frontal system. Of course, there is already a fairly rich observing infrastructure in the Northeast, Some fraction of that's depicted here in the various different dots. Those are mostly comprised of a combination of Gulf of Maine observing systems and National Data Buoy Center observing systems, as well as some other proposed and active research. What you would see, though, or what we argued in this proposal, is that within that observing system, there is not a sufficient depiction of the shelf slope interaction. There's not a sufficient resolution of that frontal system that I described. And so those three boxes, the yellow, red, and white boxes, are where we're proposing a multi-scale array to address that exchange problem. The Ocean Observatory's initiative technically is geared towards pushing the state of the art in a variety of observing subsystems and trying to bring those all to bear to the extent they apply to a given observing system or to an installation or observatory. So here you see a depiction of the kinds of elements that we are working on either procuring through bid proposals or constructing in order to develop this array. Part of the goal I mentioned earlier, interdisciplinary and broad representation of scientific processes. You see here a sense of the breadth of observations. We're not only going after temperature, salinity, currents, which are the low-hanging fruit. We're trying very hard to get a multidisciplinary sensor suite that will include biologically and chemically relevant measurements. Zooming in on that array then, this picture that I showed before, you see that the inner region there is where a moored array will be sited. The next biggest box is where autonomous vehicles will be intermittently run. And the large white box is where about six ocean gliders will operate. If the main, the heart of the array, I guess you would say, is this moored array. And that's depicted in the next slide in a cartoon form. There are seven sites in that array, and four of those sites are occupied by a single installation, a single mooring. Three of the sites actually have two installations, a surface mooring adjacent to another profiling mooring. And without going into all the details, the belief here or the philosophy was that the state of the art of these moored systems is such that you cannot obtain the desired information from a single mooring type. They both have advantages and disadvantages. And so at multiple locations, we have proposed two concurrently occupied with two different mooring types. This is important to recognize in terms of what this installation looks like in a sense to as a navigation hazard, for example, and as a obstacle in the ocean. There are a number of slides like this. I won't go through them all. I'll just pick the one here as an example. Each installation, again, we've tried to be as comprehensive as we can and include a variety of data types. And it's the thought process here is to recognize that these data, to the extent practical, and is practical for almost everything, we found, at least at some rate of update rate, these data will be available publicly through an internet-based server, which the details have yet to be defined. But at some rate, which might be once an hour, say, would be a reasonable target. Surface meteorology, waves, temperature, salinity, oxygen, pH, optical properties, chlorophyll, nitrate, and other information will be available to researchers, of course, but also to anyone who's interested, with the threshold being probably a requirement to register. And that would probably be all that's required to get data. So I'll just move through these. There are these multiple platforms. They're designed to go at different parts of the water column and different particular structures and phenomena of interest driven by the science goals. So we talked a little bit there about the moorings. I presented some details on the moorings. There are these other two elements, gliders and AUVs. Because the front is on small scales and evolves rapidly, we found that a moored array alone was not going to be adequate. and that you needed movable assets in order to really address the system completely. And so we're proposing slow, long endurance gliders combined with faster short-term AUVs as the way to address this rapidly changing environment. How would these assets be used? You see some proposed examples here. The black crosses are where the moorings would be proposed to be sited. I'll show a detailed figure of that later. And we would take half a dozen gliders, and for example, in one sort of pattern, they may run back and forth concurrently across the shelf out to the slope sea, and they would be able to handle the kind of track length and endurance that you see described there, about 2,000 kilometers in 3 months. The AUVs go more quickly, but expend much more power per mission, and they therefore operate in a smaller area, shorter track length, much shorter mission times, only about a day or so, and they would have to be replenished with power from our moored system using a docking mechanism in order to repeat those tracks. Here's the way the mortar array would look relative to isobaths from some fairly high-resolution bathymetry. And if you think back to that cross-section where I showed the salinity front and the velocity jet, and in your mind's eye you kind of overlay that sort of six-mile scale on here, you can see why, from our perspective, the moorings are spaced as closely as they are. And we certainly recognize that this approach, designed from the science perspective, certainly creates some navigational issues, as opposed, in addition to just pure operational issues out in this area as we cross the this very active and productive area with a picket fence of moorings. And this is where we've had a lot of discussion to date, and I think much more is going to be required to come up with a workable solution. The circles that you see there, so the crosses represent the nominal center of the site. As I discussed, in some sites there are more than one, there's more than one mooring there, so they would not be necessarily at this location of that cross. They would have to be separated. And so for that reason, among others, including the fact that each mooring has a watch circle itself, we have proposed a buffer zone or a navigational safety zone of about a half a mile is something we believe is appropriate, and that's what those circles are. So those are proposed sort of navigational hazard areas. In order to try and make headway on this, we've proposed, part of the NEPA process requires this, what we call a micro-siting process, and that is to get from that nominal array design that I just showed to a workable, installable system that we can agree on with the shared use of the ocean with the fishing community and others. And we have kind of worked up a simple description of what we call our requirements. Those are from the science side, what we are trying to achieve. And we think a useful dialogue would be to try to get similar, I don't know if requirements is the right word, but similar restraints, restrictions, just needs from the fishing community to try and see how and where these overlap and where they conflict. And we have in a few public meetings attempted to get this process off the ground and describe the wiggle room, maybe is the non-technical term to call it, the wiggle room in this array installation from the science side and how that matches up with what the fishing community would like to see in order to mitigate their problems. So that's the end. We're ended up with a formal presentation. Again, I wanted to try and be quick and cover a lot of ground, and probably the opening the floor to some questions might be the most effective. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right, Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. It appears that the area of concern is like 5 by 15 nautical miles is what you propose. And certainly, I think we could all see the value to the information from a scientific point of view that you're trying to collect. And I haven't been closely watching the process, aware that it was going on and that you had some public hearings, but I'm just wondering, you know, what process you're going to utilize for sort of resolving some of the conflicting use issues and with the industry and how you, you know, envision you're going to proceed with that. Public hearings are generally the best way for conflict resolution, and what process do you see moving forward?
Yeah, that's a good point, and I think I would personally say that I've learned just what you said. Public meetings are not, it turns out, a good way to do that. We are under certain constraints due to the NEPA process that the initial implementation or presentation actually has to be in these forums as they have been so far. I can't speak in detail to how that's going to evolve, but my goal would be, from my perspective, the goal is to move out of that constrained process that dictates certain kinds of interactions and instead get to a point where we can talk as the, what would you call it, the conceivers and potential operators of this system, which is, in this case, the OOI needs to talk to the actual users of that ocean space in a more direct way and try and understand what the key, what the most difficult issues are, the most contentious issues, and try to resolve them. So that's a non-specific way, I guess, of saying I think that the process needs to evolve from what it is currently to something that's more effective, and I don't know exactly what that will be.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the Pioneer array that's come to our attention is 5 by 15 with 8 fixed buoys, roughly 8. The picture looks
seven,
like there's 8, 7 or 8.
Yeah, it depends how you count it. So okay. There's 7 sites, I think, 10
right.
buoys, all 10 moorings altogether in those
okay.
7 sites.
In a 5 by 15. And your preference would be not to close the area 5 by 15, but,
oh, no.
but to have these buoys lighted and to have a half-mile buffer zone around each. So that's the Pioneer array. And where now, does that array stay in place to monitor things forever? And what is the long-term plan, to have several Pioneer arrays in each ecosystem? Or, you know, what's the long-term plan in terms of impact? How many 5 by 15 sites?
Yeah, excellent question. I should have mentioned that. This was specifically designed to be a finite duration. So this is a 5-year plan from the installation in 2014, I guess, or the critical date from the program side would be what they call commissioning. But so from that commissioning date, 5 years is the life of this array at this location. The National Science Foundation view of the future then is that the science community, much as they sort of proposed or got approval for this activity, would propose the next location for this array. There probably would be only one, is my expectation. One could imagine that the 5 years after the New England shelf, a very compelling proposal is made to move this infrastructure to the Gulf of Mexico, and it's installed there for 5 years and on.
Dr. Pierce.
I'm always in favor of the gathering of environmental information that will give us a better appreciation for the dynamics of the ocean and how that might affect you know, the species that we manage. To what extent, in the planning of this enterprise, was the Northeast Fisheries Science Center involved? Obviously, they have ecosystem concerns. We'll hear a presentation from Mike Fogarty later on, ecosystem-based management, the need for environmental information. I see many logos here in your presentation, a lot of West Coast operations, but clearly, you know, the local knowledge is important, the kinds of information that needs to be gathered in order to assist our fisheries biologists and ecologists. So, were they involved at all in the planning of this enterprise?
Yes, good question, and I guess I'll answer it from a couple different perspectives. One is I will take personal responsibility that I was really the one charged with developing those interactions. I think they were inadequate, and I would take that criticism. At the same time, those discussions have been ongoing, and they have been going for, I would say, roughly 3 years. And we've started in areas that to me made sense, such as the NOAA Cooperative Institute, where Woods Hole and NOAA work together and where we have had pretty strong interactions with the Fisheries Science Center. I've given talks at the Fisheries Science Center and tried to engage and have continued ongoing discussions with certain individuals there. So the third perspective then would be to say that those interactions are real and they do exist. I think they have not been adequate, and I'm open to information or feedback on how to make that more effective.
Okay, and my last question is, you've indicated a half-mile buffer, which is, I guess, one mile in diameter around the
correct.
Road. Okay, so you've indicated that that is, at this point in time, the preferred buffer. So can we assume that you or others with whom you associate will be looking to this council for some specific rules and regulations in federal waters that will restrict fishing activities in the areas where the array is actually placed? If indeed that is the case, then because this process takes time, the implementation of many rules and regulations, the timeline would be necessary for us to know. So what you want and also when you would need it, that would be critical for us to continue to engage with you to determine what is required.
Yes, and as with many of these things, we're certainly still learning. Our proposed approach is to work through the Coast Guard, the Army Corps, and establish procedures for private agency navigation to develop the protocols for how the buoys will be outfitted, the standard stuff obviously will be there, and to develop language for what I believe is called areas to be avoided, which is what this sort of half-a-mile radius zone would be categorized as. We had no foregone conclusion or intention to restrict fishing per se in any way, rather to treat this as a navigational issue, provide the correct guidance and suggested region which we thought that guidance should be enforced, and then, as you probably all well know, the adherence to those guidelines is a voluntary issue. And so what we expect, how this will come to a head, is that we need to have, as a program, a policy, and we're developing that now, and we'd like to vet that also with the community, and that may be a good place for help from this council. It's a policy for, let's call it entanglement for the sake of a better word, interactions, between our gear and somebody else's gear. That's where I expect the issues will arise. We have no intention of closing anything to fishing.
David Gettle.
Yeah, thank you. On the looking at the gliders and the AUVs, I assume they have some kind of propulsion unit. It's kind of hard to tell from the picture. Do they have any kind of guidance system to avoid fixed gear?
They do. The AUVs have a propeller. The gliders actually have a very simple minor propulsion. They just make themselves either heavier or lighter, and as they go up and down, they kind of glide. So they have no propeller or anything like that. They do have navigational systems. They do have tracks that can be requested. They don't always fly the track you request exactly. But they do not have what I would characterize as avoidance capability.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask is there's an awful lot of fixed gear in the area that you propose to operate, and they have a lot of vertical lines, and vertical lines and propellers don't mix well. For your edification, I mean, you probably will lose some of your units into entanglements, and you may want to consider some kind of retrieval system or pinger or something that lets you know where it crashed and burned. And the second one was on the fixed array. I can tell you from extensive experience up here, we had the UNH, we call it the fish farm, and they had a whole bunch of buoys out there with a whole bunch of lights and strobes, and it was sighted outside the shipping lane to Portsmouth. And they lost a lot of equipment, despite, you know, strobes and radar reflectors and all the things that are required by the law. And they lost it to what we call the first rule of the road, which we the short version is the big march on and the little sink. And, you know, you are out here by the shipping lanes to New York. You know, some 900-foot freighter with some cook on watch, nobody told him how to push the buttons on the autopilot, isn't going to go around things. He's just going to keep going through them. So, again, you kind of want to, no matter how you sight it, no matter how you mark it, you want to have some kind of retrieval capabilities for your gear, because chances are somebody's going to blunder into it and chop it off. Kind of like a word of warning, just based on our own experience right here locally.
Point well taken. Thank you.
Who else? Well, thanks. Thanks, Al. And maybe as you get closer to what you call commissioning date, you can come back and inform us as to what's going on.
Yeah, well, if I may, let's not wait that long. I mean, I'm happy to come back anytime. I know your time is precious. I don't want to take up your council time. I expect that as people kind of mull this over and start thinking about the implications, there are things you're going to want to tell us. And, you know, my door is open, my email is open, and we could certainly come back and discuss it in a forum like this as well. So As I've sort of tried to allude to in a couple areas, I've learned a lot in this process. I think I'm far from fully comprehending the situation that we're in terms of interacting with the fisheries. And so the feedback, contentious as it may be, you know, we want to hear it. So please let me know.
Thanks, Al. Okay, we'll break for lunch right now. Be back at 1:30.